And the Israeli military killed more than 95 university professors, hundreds of teachers, and thousands of students in what has been a devastating assault on Palestinian education. All major universities in Gaza, including the Islamic University, Al-Azhar, Al-Isra, have been destroyed. And as students globally continue to rise and voice their protest against the genocide in Gaza, we must remember and mourn the enormous losses suffered by the educational community. And I call on the student movement to continue to honor Rifat's memory and legacy, and to pay tribute to the countless educators and students who have perished under Israel's bombs. This is the best way to honor our colleagues and those who have carried the message of education in Gaza and unfortunately have been murdered by Israel, and to continue carrying their message forward.
Jihad Abu Salim, again, our condolences on the death of your friend Rifat El-Arir, and now the death of his oldest daughter, Shema Rifat El-Arir, her two-month-old baby boy, and her husband, just killed in Israeli airstrike. Jihad Abu Salim is a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza. He's executive director of the Jerusalem Fund. That does it for our broadcast. To see the poem Rifat El-Arir wrote, If I Must Die, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and KBOO's Spring Membership Drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and May 25th and support Avant-Garde Airwaves.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this Spring Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Federal Drug Enforcement Administration is poised to reclassify marijuana as a lower-risk drug. Governor Kotek's office releases emails that show First Lady Amy Kotek Wilson was the reason for staff departures. And the winner of Oregon's Powerball jackpot has been revealed. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Last August, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommended that marijuana be reclassified from being considered a Schedule 1 drug to a lower-risk category. Now it seems the Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA, is likely to accept that. Yesterday, Attorney General Merrick Garland said he would recommend loosening restrictions on marijuana as well. For more, we turn to KBOO's Doug McVeigh.
The Drug Enforcement Administration is reportedly planning to downgrade the legal classification of marijuana. The Department of Health and Human Services recommended to DEA in August of 2023 that marijuana should be removed from Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive classification in the Controlled Substances Act, and placed in Schedule 3. Associated Press reported on the morning of Tuesday, April 30th, that DEA plans to accept the HHS recommendation. What this means for the marijuana industry is unclear, though some concerns have been raised. In a January 2024 report, the Congressional Research Service noted that, quote, moving marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 without other legal changes would not bring the state legal, medical, or recreational industry into compliance with federal controlled substances law. With respect to medical marijuana, a key difference between placement in Schedule 1 and Schedule 3 is that substances in Schedule 3 have an accepted medical use and may lawfully be dispensed by prescription, while substances in Schedule 1 cannot. However, prescription drugs must be approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Although FDA has approved some drugs derived from or related to cannabis, marijuana itself is not an FDA-approved drug. End quote. The Congressional Research Service also noted that manufacture, distribution, and possession of recreational marijuana would remain illegal under federal law were it to be rescheduled. To find out more about the impact of possible rescheduling on patients, I spoke with Anthony Taylor, Legislative Director of Compassionate Oregon.
I'm encouraged by the news, actually. You know, right from the start, everyone knew that cannabis had medicinal value, and it's long overdue, the rescheduling. One of the most important things I think it's going to do for everyone, not just this state, but across the country, is it's going to open the doors to research a lot wider, and it will enable a lot more of the beneficial aspects of cannabis to come to the forefront and become part of the new healthcare toolkit.
That was Anthony Taylor, Legislative Director of Compassionate Oregon. If DEA does accept the rescheduling recommendation, then before the change could go into effect, the proposal would first have to be approved by the Office of Management and Budget, then published in the Federal Register for public comment. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
Emails released by Governor Kotek's office show First Lady Amy Kotek Wilson was the reason for staff departures in Kotek's office. Three senior members of Kotek's staff announced they were leaving the governor's team in late March. They did not publicly state the reason for their departure. Speculation surrounded whether they had left over ethics concerns about First Lady Amy Kotek Wilson's influence in the Kotek government. Wilson had played a senior advisory role on issues like behavioral health. On Friday, Kotek's office released more than 6,000 pages of emails and documents in response to public records requests filed by Willamette Week, OPB, and other news outlets. Emails reveal the departing staff raised questions about Wilson. They assert that staffers were not informed about Wilson's presence in official meetings and that staffers sought clarification on the First Lady's official role. While it's common in other states for first spouses to play an official role, Oregon has a single concerning precedent. Governor John Kitzhaber resigned in 2015 over allegations First Lady Sylvia Hayes had used her position for personal gain. A federal government investigation into the allegations was eventually dropped. The email trove revealed that Governor Kotek had been expanding Wilson's role for months since January. It wasn't until April 3rd that Kotek asked the government's ethics commission to weigh in on her plans to create an office of the first spouse. Big Pharma uses red meat rhetoric in a fight over drug costs. A school shooting mother opposes guns for teachers. Campus protests against the war in Gaza continue, and activists decry the killing of reporters there. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
What's gone wrong is calling in the police. The protest was calm, well organized, not violent. There was little, if any, intimidation of anyone. They have not shouted out slogans in support of Hamas.
Columbia University professor Bruce Robbins tells CNN that the media and politicians are not accurately describing the peaceful Gaza protests there, and should not confuse it with more violent events just off campus. But Columbia student Ben Solomon also tells CNN he doesn't feel safe.
Particularly the last few days, I've felt uncomfortable around this university. I've felt like this is not a welcoming environment.
After negotiations about divesting from Israel broke down, student protesters said they would defy orders to disperse, despite a threat of suspension. And the protests continued to spread. The Associated Press reports more than 1,000 students have been arrested on scores of campuses. Medea Benjamin, a co-founder of the anti-war group Code Pink, says she was thrown out of the hotel hosting the glitzy White House Correspondents' Dinner. Benjamin says she held up a sign reading 100 members of the press killed in Gaza.
Quite ironic, because tonight was all about press, press freedom, and it seems like standing here with the sign is something that's a lot worse than 100 journalists in Gaza being killed.
Missouri Republican State Senate Leader Cindy O'Loughlin says Big Pharma is trying to confuse legislators with unrelated hot-button topics like abortion access and illegal immigration in a last-ditch effort to stop the state from joining a program that would force drug makers to sell medicines at a discount.
Appealing to nuclear topics, which really do not apply in this situation, is a disingenuous way to try to defeat a bill that is actually good for Missouri.
O'Loughlin says the program's transparent and uses the tax money saved to help low-income families deal with chronic conditions like diabetes. The drug makers object to the government forcing them to give significant discounts. Tennessee's legislature has been fighting over gun control since last year's shooting in Nashville. After sharp debate, lawmakers moved to arm teachers, but Covenant School parent Becky Hansen cried at a House hearing when describing how her five-year-old son's teacher saved her students and said giving her a gun would just have made the situation worse.
Our teacher had the wherewithal when she realized that what they thought they needed to do for a fire alarm was actually an active shooter, to turn it into a race, to not scare my five-year-old. There is no way that my sweet teacher could have also held and properly ejected a weapon.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Wetlands can act as natural wastewater treatment plants. Since its establishment in 2014, the Fern Hill Wetlands in Oregon has been a thriving environment that also filters out pollutants. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Wastewater treatment plants across the country are using the natural filtration system of wetlands to clean water and attracting sightseers along the way. In Oregon, the Clean Water Services Utility established the 90-acre Fern Hill Wetlands a decade ago. The environment has been thriving. Birdwatchers have seen more than 240 different species in the marshlands that connect to the Tualatin River in Forest Grove, outside Portland. Jerry Kinnear is Clean Water Services Water Resources Project Manager and helped design the project.
I always say wetlands are the kidneys of the earth. That's what they've been doing. They filter pollutants, they slow water down, they capture sediment. We're just sort of harnessing that process that's been going on for billions of years and taking advantage of it.
The company also notes natural wetlands treatment cost about half as much as building a concrete treatment system. Similar systems exist in places like Florida, Arizona, and across the southern border in the Mexican state of Baja California. The Fern Hill Wetlands' popularity has also led to the potential for bad press. In 2020, cackling geese ate fungus-contaminated grain in a nearby field, which led to a mass die-off in the wetlands. Kinnear says to some, it looked like the wetlands were the cause, although that was not the case.
They're looking at us like, is it the water, or what are you doing about this? We're in a fishbowl out there.
Recycled water is important to many ecosystems, including the lower stretch of the Tualatin River, where a reservoir and treated wastewater from Clean Water Services' four treatment plants can account for more than 80% of late summer flow. Kinnear says urban wetlands have been severed from their water sources, and treatment plants in the form of wetlands can help rectify that.
We can use this as a tool to restore wetland function, get all sorts of other benefits, wildlife habitat improvements. I mean, people value green spaces here in Oregon, and this is one way to do it.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. This story was produced with original reporting from Bryn Nelson for Yes Magazine.
A 20-year-old Oregon man was arrested for the deliberate killing of nearly 20,000 salmon at a local fish hatchery. On Earth Day, Joshua Alexander Heckathorne broke into the hatchery building in Reedsport, stole a bottle of bleach from a supply shed, and poured it into the rearing tank of the young salmon. Hatchery volunteers estimate that Heckathorne single-handedly eliminated 25% of the juvenile fish at the hatchery. The hatchery is a nonprofit operated by the Gardner Reedsport Winchester Bay Salmon Trout Enhancement Program. They say volunteers have worked hundreds of hours to care for the slaughtered fish, and the community is devastated about the loss. On a Facebook post, the nonprofit said specific charges will include the unlawful taking of Chinook salmon for 17,890 fish, which raises the charge to a Class C felony. Heckathorn also faces charges of making a toxic substance available to wildlife, a Class A misdemeanor. Sergeant Levy Heron with the State Patrol's Fish and Wildlife Division said in a statement, quote, "In my 25 years as a game warden, this is one of the most senseless acts I have seen." The winner of Oregon's Powerball jackpot has been revealed. Chang Saifan is a Yumean man who immigrated here from Laos. He's been battling cancer for the past 8 years. His luck changed recently with the help of the Oregon Lottery. Saifan's first name translates to success. He won the fourth largest Powerball jackpot in history, $1.3 billion. Saifan opted to take a lump sum payment of $422 million after taxes and split the winnings with his wife and a close friend who had chipped in to buy the winning ticket. Saifan hopes to raise awareness about his ethnic background and the struggles his people face. The Yumean are a part of an ethnic group originating in China. During the Vietnam War, the CIA recruited Yumean to engage in guerrilla warfare and act as spies for the U.S. When communist government officials took control of Laos, over 70% of Laotian civilians fled by foot through the jungle and across the Mekong River to get to refugee camps in Thailand. In the 1970s, the U.S. allowed refugees to come into the country and many settled in the West Coast. Today, there is a thriving Yumean community in the Portland area. Saifan immigrated to the U.S. in 1994. After everything he and his people have been through, Saifan feels relieved to be able to support his personal health as well as his loved ones, including two kids. You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during the program by going to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on creative ideas to ensure the viability of Social Security. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Eco Justice Radio. Tonight's weather is partly cloudy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy with a high of 58 degrees and a low of 40 degrees. Today in history, in 1937, the Commonwealth of the Philippines held a constitutional referendum for Filipino women on whether they should be extended the right to suffrage. Over 90% voted in the affirmative. The quote of the day is from Japanese Buddhist teacher Taisen Deshimaru, who said, quote, "To receive everything, one must open one's hands and give." Federal agency wants to give up management of lands in the Wind River Reservation. The Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes have argued it never should have been removed from the reservation in the first place. Canada's top Native leader says she was stunned by the treatment she received from Air Canada. The Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan passed a new resolution recognizing nature's inherent rights. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal agency wants to give up management of lands on the Wind River Reservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes have argued it should never have been removed from the reservation in the first place.
The Bureau of Reclamation is trying to part ways with under 60,000 acres of federal land originally removed from the reservation as part of the Riverton Reclamation Project. Located on Muddy Ridge, the land could go to the BLM or to local interests like the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes. Wes Martell is a former council member of the Eastern Shoshone tribe.
There should be no question that that land reverts back to the tribe. We're going to stand up for ourselves.
Non-tribal ranchers have grazing leases on Muddy Ridge for cattle and are worried about changes to how it's managed if the tribes receive it. A recent news report says ranchers believe that if the Bureau of Indian Affairs manages the land, they could impose different grazing regulations. In a federal court case from 2014, both tribes argued that areas north of the Wind River, like Muddy Ridge, are lawfully part of the reservation. However, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals eventually ruled against them. I'm Chris Clements.
Canada's top Native leader says she was stunned by her treatment of the country's national air carrier, Air Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the Assembly of First Nations National Chief says it was hurtful the way her headdress was dealt with on a flight.
Cindy Woodhouse-Nepenak is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. She says she's traveled before with her headdress and without any problem. But last week she boarded a plane in Montreal and carried her headdress in a special case, which she usually places in the overhead compartment. This time she stowed it under the seat in front of her because the overhead compartment was full. The Air Canada flight staff told her the case would have to be placed in the cargo hold. From there, she says things got pretty heated. She refused to give up her headdress, but flight attendants insisted the case go in the cargo. Then she didn't get it back until the pilot intervened and it was brought to her.
I think we were all pretty stunned. It was an unfortunate incident, and I just hope nobody has to ever feel like that again. I know it was a tough, tense situation in the moment, but I think it's a learning lesson on how to work together better. And I think with when it comes to Air Canada, you know, this stuff isn't new. I know.
Even Prime Minister Justin Trudeau commented on the incident.
It is an unfortunate situation that I hope is going to lead to a bit of learning.
Air Canada has since apologized and says it will review its policy. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan has passed a new resolution recognizing nature's inherent rights. It's the first step toward changing the tribal code with the ultimate goal of eventually establishing the legal right of nature in court. Amy Amu McCoy is a Sault Ste. Marie tribal member who first drafted the resolution. She says it codifies the long-held responsibility of the Anishinaabeg have to nature.
Those beings need to be respected, not relegated as resource commodities. They need to be cared for, respected, protected. And now that's the law.
Other tribal nations throughout Michigan are considering similar resolutions. It's part of a broader movement among Indigenous communities that seek to extend the same legal rights to nature that individuals and corporations already have. McCoy says this initial resolution should make it easier to pass more tribal environmental protection laws in the future. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Made in the USA is a major selling point for manufacturers, but it's also a factor in agriculture, and small farm advocates feel they've secured a big victory under a finalized federal rule adding the label to meat items. KBOO's Birdie has more on the story.
Big players in the beef and poultry industry face pressure to prepare for a new federal rule for product of USA labels. And advocates for smaller farmers and ranchers see an opportunity for those operations to reach more customers. Companies selling meat products in U.S. stores have until early 2026 to comply with the USDA rule announced this spring. Product of USA labels are sometimes slapped on a meat item for sale. Firms that outsource production overseas have been doing it because the item was packaged in the U.S. But now, all of the meat production has to be done domestically to use the label. North Dakota Farmers Union President Mark Watney likes the move.
In some respect, it should give a U.S. producer a distinctive advantage to the consumer that desires a product that is born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S.
Watney says non-corporate farms and small processors won't have to worry about big meat packing companies who opt for cheaper, less regulated production in foreign countries making the claim. While the rule is binding, use of the label is voluntary. Watney says advocates still have a long way to go in getting stronger mandates under country of origin labeling. Critics of such moves worry about disrupting international markets. Watney says the revised rule being phased in should make things less confusing for shoppers willing to pay a little extra if given assurances of where the product was produced.
So if you want something that's labeled product of the U.S., then you want to know that it went through the same and equal standards, rules, and regulations that a U.S. producer goes through.
Supporters of the USDA action suggest that removing the loophole means consumers won't be taken advantage of or second-guess the packaging information they look at. The move comes amid new federal data showing the number of farms shrinking around the country as market concentration remains a force within agriculture. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Birdie.
Alarm bells continue to ring over supposed Chinese preparations to attack Taiwan. But these are false alarms based on incorrect readings of Chinese priorities and an undervaluing of U.S.-China diplomacy that has eased tensions. In a word, there is no crisis. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Last week, my commentary concerned danger signs in Europe over a potential World War III. It's the most likely locale of an all-out war, but there are others, including the Taiwan Strait, though I will argue that the prospects for war there are far less than they need to be. Ever since Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping met in Beijing early in 2022 and issued a joint statement of solidarity, pundits left and right have sounded the alarm over Taiwan. They incorrectly concluded from that statement that it is only a matter of time before China, presumably with Russian support, attacks Taiwan. I can't tell you how many times I have read predictions that in a few or several years, the Chinese will be sending forces across the strait or conducting a cyber war operation that would essentially shut Taiwan down. Here's an example that was recently published. Retired Admiral Mike Studeman, former head of the Office of Naval Analysis, sees a Chinese invasion of Taiwan in the near future. Most likely, he says, in the back half of the 2020s or front half of the 2030s. Rather than seeing China as too preoccupied with domestic problems to conduct a war, Studeman contends that, quote, China's trajectory signals deepening danger and a hardening of Xi's intent to execute an act of aggression, similar to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There's that analogy to Ukraine again. Among other factors in support of his thesis, he cites Xi's ambitions, China's conventional and nuclear weapon modernization, and recent military deployments. He turns every move by Xi into an argument for China's imminent hostility, such as the argument that his economic policies, with emphasis on self-reliance, demonstrates security over the economy. Even the exceptional costs of a war with the U.S. over Taiwan would, in Studeman's view, be bearable. In the coming years, he writes, Xi may conclude that he has everything to gain and nothing to lose by waiting any longer. Allow me to deconstruct this analysis, which, again, is very similar to others that have come from members of Congress, military leaders, usually based in the Pacific, and a few right-wing China specialists. First, the writer avoids any discussion of U.S. policy on Taiwan. The analysis never considers provocative moves by the U.S. during the last two administrations that have raised Chinese concerns about U.S. intentions. Those moves are both military, huge new arms sales to Taiwan, and diplomatic, sending senior U.S. and congressional leaders to Taiwan. The thrust of these moves is to elevate Taiwan's status as a U.S. ally and suggest that the U.S. might support crossing Beijing's red line on Taiwan, which is the island's declaration of independence. Second, this writer and many others do not take seriously statements from both Biden and Xi, as well as other top officials, that have lowered tensions in the Taiwan Strait. Biden has several times assured China that the U.S. supports the One China principle, that is, not a separate China and Taiwan, and does not support Taiwan's independence. For his part, Xi has consistently said that China stands by its traditional policy of peaceful unification between China and Taiwan, so long as Taiwan does not declare independence. Most recently, China called for talks with the U.S. on adopting a common policy of no first use of nuclear weapons. Third, these doomsayers misconstrue what is happening in China's economy and military. It is not a matter of security over the economy, as Studeman says, but of the reverse. Economic development is the first order of security, Chinese officials have been emphasizing, and one reason for saying so is U.S. export controls on advanced technology, forcing China into technological self-reliance. In a word, China is not on a wartime footing, as these analyses would have us believe, but rather is hunkering down for long-term economic competition with the U.S. It's probably no accident that several of these alarmist comments have come from people concerned with U.S. policy in Asia. Whether military or civilian, they want U.S. security policy to refocus on the China threat. And they're willing to throw enormous sums into further upgrading already preponderant U.S. air and naval power in the Pacific. Yes, China is rapidly modernizing its air and naval forces in East Asia and is accelerating the buildup of its nuclear forces too. But ask any U.S. military leader if he or she would trade U.S. forces for China's and see what the answer would be. The U.S. not only has military bases and bilateral security ties all over Asia, from Korea and Japan in the northeast to Australia, Philippines, the Pacific Islands, and Thailand to the south. It also has an expanding system of security partnerships that now includes AUKUS, Australia, United Kingdom, U.S., and the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, the Quad of U.S., India, Australia, and Japan. China has nothing comparable in military forces, bases, or partnerships. In a crisis, China will essentially be on its own. So here's the bottom line. The Taiwan Strait is a potential flashpoint, but need not be. Chinese party and military leaders are not so reckless as to believe there is nothing to lose by attacking Taiwan. U.S. and Chinese diplomacy have largely been successful at maintaining the status quo and avoiding violent confrontations. Thus, while there is no crisis, false alarms help create one. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes David Rosenberg, Doug McVeigh, Reed Johnson, and Birdie. The producers are Matea Carlin and Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
Listener sponsored stations count on you, not Arbitron. So when you push their buttons, you get